Something strange has been going on in government schools, especially where the matter of reading is concerned. Abundant data exists to show that by 1840, the incidence of complex literacy in the United States was between 93 and 100%, wherever such a thing mattered. Yet compulsory schooling existed nowhere. Between the two world wars, schoolmen seem to have been assigned the task of terminating our universal reading proficiency. The deeds were monstrous, but the doer, Adolf Eichmann, was quite ordinary, commonplace, and neither demonic nor monstrous. There was no sign in him of firm ideological convictions or specific evil motives, and the only notable characteristic one could detect in his past behavior, as well as in his behavior during the trial, was something entirely negative. It was not stupidity, but thoughtlessness. Might not the problem of good and evil, our faculty for telling right from wrong, be connected with our faculty for thought? That quote from Hannah Arendt, The Life of the Mind. And Gatto continues, I always knew school books and real books were different. Most kids do. But I remained vague on any particular grounds for my prejudice until one day, tired of the simple-minded junior high school English curriculum, I decided to teach Moby Dick to eighth-grade classes. A friendly assistant principal smuggled a school edition into the book purchases, and we were able to weigh anchor the next fall. What a book! Ishmael, the young seaman who relates Melville's tale, is a half-orphan by decree of fate, sentenced never to know a natural home again. But Ahab is no accidental victim. He has consciously willed his own exile from a young wife and child, from the fruits of his wealth, and from earth itself in order to pursue his vocation of getting even. Revenge on the natural order is what drives him. War against God and family. To me, it defines the essence of Americanness. It's no accident that America's three classic novels, Moby Dick, The Scarlet Letter, and Huckleberry Finn, each deal with ambiguous families, or that each emerges from a time not far from either side of the Civil War. America had been an inferno for families, as Melville, Hawthorne, and Twain all knew. Midway through our first full century as a nation, the nearly universal American experience of homelessness found its voice. Ishmael is a half-orphan. Ahab, an absentee father and husband. The harpooners, expatriate men of color. Pearl, a bastard. Hester, an adulteress. The Reverend Dimmesdale, a sexual predator and runaway father. Huck Finn, de facto an adoptee. Jim, a twice uprooted African slave. When we think what our schools became, we need to recall what a great pile of us are homeless. We long for homes we can never have, as long as we have institutions like school, television, corporation, and government in loco parentis. Patricia Lines of the U.S. Department of Education, in trying honorably to discuss what the rank and file of homeschoolers actually do, finally declared it seems to be wrapped up closely with a feeling of intense interest in the life of the community, close quote. Above anything else, she found loyalty in the warp and woof of family. Homeschoolers are tremendously loyal as family members. They are suspicious of television and other less intimate influences. They eat as a family. They socialize as a family. They attend church as a family. They become members of an extended homeschooling community. American great fiction is about individuals broken from family. The closest they come to satisfying the universal yearning is a struggle for surrogates, like the strange connection between Pearl, Hester, and the Dark Forest. America's most fascinating storytellers focus on the hollowness of American public life. We have no place to go when work is done. Our inner life, long extinguished, our public work in remaking the world can never be done because personal homework isn't available to us. There's no institutional solace for this malady. In outrage at our lonely fate, we lay siege to the family sanctuary wherever it survives, as Ahab lay siege to the seas for his accursed whale. For this and other reasons long lost, I decided to teach Moby Dick to my 8th grade classes, including the dumb ones. I discovered right away that the white whale was just too big for 45-minute bell breaks. I couldn't divide it comfortably to fit the schedule. Melville's book is too vast to say just what the right way to teach it really is. It speaks to every reader privately. To grapple with it demanded elastic time, not the fixed bell breaks of junior high. Indeed, it offered so many choices of purpose, some aesthetic, some historical, some social, some philosophical, some theological, some dramatic, some economic, that compelling the attention of a room full of young people to any one aspect seemed willful and arbitrary. Soon after I began teaching Moby Dick, I realized the school edition wasn't a real book, but a kind of disguised indoctrination, providing all the questions, a scientific addition to the original text designed to make the book teacher-proof and student-proof. If you even read those questions, let alone answer them, there would be no chance ever again for a private exchange between you and Melville. The invisible editor would have preempted it. The editors of the school edition provided a package of prefabricated questions and more than 100 chapter-by-chapter abstracts and interpretations of their own. Many teachers considered this a gift. It does the thinking for them. If I didn't assign these questions, kids wanted to know why not. Their parents wanted to know why not. Unless everyone duly parroted the party line set down by the book editor, children used to getting high marks became scared and angry. The school text of Moby Dick had been subtly denatured. Worse than useless, it was actually dangerous. So I pitched it out and bought a set of undoctored books with my own money. The school edition of Moby Dick asked all the right questions, so I had to throw it away. Real books don't do that. Real books demand people actively participate by asking their own questions. Books that show you the best questions to ask aren't just stupid, they hurt the mind under the guise of helping it, exactly the way standardized tests do. Real books, unlike school books, can't be standardized. They are eccentric. No book fits everyone. If you think about it, schooled people like school books are much alike. Some folks find that desirable for economic reasons. The discipline organizing our economy and our politics derive from mathematical and interpretive exercises, the accuracy of which depends upon customers being much alike and very predictable. People who read too many books get quirky. We can't have too much eccentricity, or it would bankrupt us. Market research depends on people behaving as if they were alike. It doesn't matter whether they are or not. One way to see the difference between school books and real books like Moby Dick is to examine different procedures which separate librarians, the custodians of real books, from school teachers, the custodians of school books. To begin with, libraries are usually comfortable, clean, and quiet. They are orderly places where you can actually read, instead of just pretending to read. For some reason, libraries are never age-segregated, nor do they presume to segregate readers by questionable tests of ability any more than farms or forests or oceans do. The librarian doesn't tell me what to read, doesn't tell me what sequence of reading I have to follow, doesn't grade my reading. The librarian trusts me to have a worthwhile purpose of my own. I appreciate that, and trust the library in return. Some other significant differences between libraries and schools. The librarian lets me ask my own questions and helps me when I want help, not when she decides I need it. If I feel like reading all day long, that's okay with the librarian, who doesn't compel me to stop at intervals by ringing a bell in my ear. The library keeps its nose out of my home. It doesn't send letters to my family, nor does it issue orders on how I should use my reading time at home. The library doesn't play favorites. It's a democratic place, as seems proper in a democracy. If the books I want are available, I get them, even if that decision deprives someone more gifted and talented than I am. The library never humiliates me by posting ranked lists of good readers. It presumes good reading is its own reward and doesn't need to be held up as an object lesson to bad readers. One of the strangest differences between a library and a school is that you almost never see a kid behaving badly in a library. The library never makes predictions about my future based on my past reading habits. It tolerates eccentric reading because it realizes free men and women are often very eccentric. Finally, the library has real books, not school books. I know the Moby Dick I find in the library won't have questions at the end of the chapter or be scientifically Baudelaireized. Library books are not written by collective pens, at least not yet. Real books conform to the private curriculum of each author, not to the invisible curriculum of a corporate bureaucracy. Real books transport us to an inner realm of solitude and unmonitored mental reflection in a way school books and computer programs can't. If they were not devoid of such capacity, they would jeopardize school routines devised to control behavior. Real books conform to the private curriculum of particular authors, not to the demands of bureaucracy.